You're listening to the Just One Outdoors Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Just One Outdoors Podcast. Today, we have another turkey episode, which is kind of odd because, you know, it's talking turkey in July. But we have a guest that, honestly, I've been wanting to get on for a while now. I'm familiar with him, kind of with Jeremy from Fit to Hunt, kind of got to know you from that, but also know the O2 podcast. But then just talking to you before, there's like six or seven other podcasts that he's involved in. But Paul Campbell joins the show today. We're really excited to have him on. Pretty much, he might compete with Trevin for the biggest turkey fanatic we know. But Paul, welcome to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself a little bit better than I ever could? What are you involved in? What do you like to do? How'd you get started hunting?
Yeah, so Austin, Cam, thanks for having me on the phone, on the show. Jeez, I'm looking at my phone. That's what makes me good. But Trevin, if you're listening to this, I've never met you. We're kindred spirits if you're willing to talk about turkeys in July. So, Trevin, good for you. Hang in. Don't let Austin and Cam beat you down with your turkey obsession. So, I'm just a guy from Ohio. I love to turkey hunt. I do a lot of podcasts. Austin, we talked about that earlier. I do the O2 podcast with Andrew Muntz, a real good buddy of mine, all Ohio focused, Ohio outdoors. I do the How to Hunt Turkeys podcast, which is really geared towards people that are new hunters, people that want to become better hunters. It's very much a teaching podcast, but I think the best way for a lot of people to learn is through storytelling. So that's what it is. I've had some really good guests on there, talking about their experiences in the turkey woods, and that's a really good, been a lot of fun. I've got a new show dropping the first part of August, the Turkey Season podcast. It's going to be on the OK Hunters Podcast Network. Great group of guys, if you're not familiar with them. And then just recently I've been doing some shows for the National Wild Turkey Federation's podcast, the Turkey Call All Access podcast. So I am a full-time employee of the National Wild Turkey Federation. I've been doing that for a little over 2 years now. And I'm fortunate enough I get to talk about wild turkeys, wild turkey hunting, hunters, and conservation work 365 days a year. And I do it. I take advantage of it. Christmas morning, I'm sitting there, I'm texting members, I'm texting volunteers, thanks for your support. And so it's neat. I really, it's something that I've embraced. To answer your question, how I got started hunting, I didn't grow up in a hunting family. I had grandparents, one of my grandfathers, on my dad's side of the family, he hunted. I never met him. He died like in the 70s. I was born in the 80s. My dad didn't hunt. And I think it was always kind of like, I remember watching hunting shows as a kid on, TNT or ESPN2. You'd get, those old school cable, hunting shows. I always enjoyed it, but my parents didn't do it. We lived in Columbus, Ohio, so I didn't have access to it. It wasn't something that was a part of my life. So fast forward to 2008. If you guys remember that, your listeners remember, the economy was really just piss poor. I mean, I worked on, I was golf course superintendent. The golf course industry was just laying people off left and right. It was hard to, quite frankly, keep a job, man. July 21st, 2008, my dad died, 54 years old, had a heart attack, died on his way to work. And so my life was in free fall after that. I mean, I was just dealing with this crazy economy. I was a single father. My dad just died. I was drinking all the time. I was just a mess, man. And a really good friend of mine, grew up hunting. His dad had died about the year before mine. And he could see that, like, I was in a bad place. He said, "Hey, do you want to go fishing?" I'm like, "Yeah, whatever, I'll go fishing." So we go fishing. We go out to his mother-in-law's pond, and I catch like what I would four or five pound bass, and I was hooked. Like, pun absolutely intended, man. I was just like, "Oh my god, this is amazing! What else is there in this giant outdoors that I've never spent much time in?" And he's like, "I think this is cool. You should try turkey hunting." So, and that was just a few weeks down the road. I think I caught that fish in March of 2009, and my first turkey season at what would have been in 2009. Spring of 2009. And when he said you should try turkey hunt, my response, Cam, was, "What the hell's a turkey? Like, that's a thing, like a wild turkey? I didn't know what a wild turkey was. I just my experience with turkeys was the same as most of America on the Thanksgiving table, right? And the ones you see in the cartoons." And So I not only did I not know that wild turkeys were a thing, I didn't know that people hunted them, but I'm like, you know what? I have literally nothing else going for me. Let's try it. So I borrowed a shotgun. I bought the cheapest Walmart camo I could get my hands on, that Mossy Oak Obsession stuff, like that real thick, like made in China cotton. You know what I'm talking about? Like, yep. It doesn't even hold water. Like, it's just like it's impervious to air or water, and it smells and it's hot. So I bought all of that, and I went to this little and forgive me, I'm going to get hopefully not long winded, but so I go to this little tiny hunting store in McConnellsville, Ohio. I get this Primo's Power Crystal Call. And it's just like this little like glass, like a crystal call. And this was, you know, 09, like YouTube was around, but it wasn't like a huge thing. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. People sure as hell weren't putting videos on about like, hey, how to condition a pod call. So I didn't know that you were supposed to rough up the surface on these pod calls. So this is like 2 weeks before the season. I cannot get this thing to make a sound, right? Cause I'm just scratching it with this striker. It's not roughed up. It's not conditioned. So I go back to the store. I bought it from him. Like, hey, man, I need a new turkey call. This one's broken. And I hand it to him, and the guy's like, you turkey hunt? I'm like, oh, yeah, I love it. I've never turkey hunted. Like, I haven't even bought my license at this point, you know? And he's like, set call. And so he takes it, and he looks at it, and he's asking me these questions. You know, you killing turkey? Oh, yeah, man, all the time. Yeah, I'm like the best turkey hunter on the planet, you know? And I didn't want to admit that I didn't know what I was doing. And he takes this call. He's like, did you know that you're supposed to rough this up? And I'm just like, no, I didn't. And so I was like, so he like roughs it up and starts calling, and he hands it to me. And I was like the Homer Simpson meme, you know, like you've seen him where he like just retreats into the bushes when he says something. I just like backed out of the store without saying a word. It was so embarrassing. And so I took that call, and my friend Kenny and I, we go out, and we're in southeastern Ohio, and we're turkey hunting. It's and you know, the first day, man, we didn't hear anything. Second day, we didn't hear anything. Third day, finally hear a turkey gobble. And there was something in me, like at that moment, like clicked. I'm like, oh my God, that's what that sounds like. Like that's a turkey gobble. And like in that moment, man, like it was, you just remember like the place that I'm in my life. I wanted to see that animal. I wanted to shoot it. I wanted to touch it. I wanted to turkey hunt for the rest of my life. I wanted to figure this out. And, man, it just hooked me. I mean, it really did. And at that time, you know, turkey hunting and learning to hunt and deer hunt, all of the things that came after that day, you know, really gave me purpose in my life. And it gave me, you know, something to focus on and something to, you know, to do that was healthy and something to do that was, you know, beneficial just to me. So that's it, man. That long answer. How did you hunt? That's it. That's how I got into it. So it took me 3 years to kill my first turkey.
That might be one
that first, like, I didn't even get close.
That might be one of the best stories of how did you get into hunting I think I've ever heard.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we'll save my first turkey kill story. We'll save that for another episode. We'll save that for spring of 24.
How about that? Hey, that works.
Yeah.
So, how did you get involved with the NWTF? I every time with that acronym, I always have to think about it because I'm like, I'm going to mess this up. I'm not really super familiar with them. I mean, we've had them on, and but as an organization, I'm not super familiar with them because I don't really consider myself a turkey hunter. I mean, I go out and I look at turkeys about every year, but haven't killed one yet. But anyway, how did you get involved with them?
Yeah, so it's funny. I'd forgotten this moment in my life until I started working with the NWTF, and you know, you can pull up and look at like membership records. I'd gone to a street fair like in Northern Ohio, and this would have been in like 2010 or 11, and someone had a turkey. There was like a booth there, right? And they had the NWTF logo, and if you remember the old logo, it had the three walking toms, and I don't think I'd killed a turkey yet, but I looked at it, and I'm like, hey, I know what that is. That's a turkey. And the guy's like, yeah, you're damn right. It's a turkey. And have you heard about the NWTF? And that was my entrance into the NWTF. And then I remember telling my friend, like, dude, did you know that there's an organization that like protects the turkey so that like we can kill them? You know? And that was like my idea, like my basic understanding of like, you know, wildlife conservation at, you know, and, you know, 12, 13 years ago at this point. But, so that was my, you know, that was my entrance into it. And just like anyone else, you know, I would go to the banquets here and there. I was a very, I guess, casual banquet attendee. It's something that, you know, growing up, you know, like when you're younger, like you just don't want to spend, something I want to spend my money on, you know, like I'd go and, you know, pay and get the membership and drink all the beer and like, you know, bid on the cheap stuff. And, the way that I got the job 2 years ago, I was looking for, man, I guess it was 3 years at this point. I was looking for a hat. We just changed the logo. I was looking for one of the old hats. I wanted to see if it was, you know, like discounted or whatever. And I got on and I saw this little like logo, you know, now hiring. I'm like, man, I wonder what the National Lawn Turkey Federation is hiring for. And I saw my job that I have now, which is director of development. So I work with major gift fundraising to the organization, with, you know, with our membership. And I'm like, man, I'm not really qualified for that, but I really like turkey hunting. I'm passionate about it. So I applied, generated an interview, and I just wrote like a really impassioned cover letter about what turkey hunting means to me. Obviously, like, you know, you listen to that story that I just told you, like, I hope you understand like how like personal it is to me. It's not just something that I do. Like, it is very much woven into the fabric of who I am. So that's how I got here. I'm very grateful for the job that I have. I'm grateful for the people that I get to work with, you know, the members and just the impacts that, that we have, you know, collectively as employees and members. So for those of you that aren't familiar with it, Cam, you said you're not, the mission of the Wild Turkey Federation is the conservation of the wild turkey and the preservation of our hunting heritage. So it's a two-part, it's a two-part mission, but you can't have one without the other, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's just kind of like a, you know, high level, what this organization is.
I've seen some cool pictures on Instagram while we're talking about your job, of you like holding some turkeys, releasing turkeys, just different things like that. Can you explain a little bit about, I think it was maybe a month or two ago when I saw it, but what were you doing there? Yeah, so what kind of cool things with your job do you get to do?
Yeah, that was back in March, and I had put some stuff on, and then the national social media accounts, you know, put some of that on. So what that was, in March, Ohio State University, in conjunction with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, started a research project here in the state of Ohio that was funded by the National Wild Turkey Federation. So one thing, I think there's some confusion across social media. The NWTF, we do not do research. The way that the North American model of wildlife conservation works, we do not do research. That is state agencies only. Everything has to go through a state agency. So they're the ones that hold wildlife in the trust of the public. And that's everything, man. That's deer, turkey, elk, fish, doesn't matter, pollinators. That's so we don't do it. I was there at that research project to take pictures, to participate in it, you know, just from like an idiot perspective, you know, I'd never, I'm not a biologist.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like an experience that I will never forget. You know, there's been a big population challenges across the United States. I'm sure you guys have heard about that. We'll definitely talk about it at some point today. But yeah, so that was during a research project, and I was only there because I was just one of the representatives of the NWTF. There's only two full-time employees here in the state of Ohio, myself and then my coworker in Northern Ohio. And the agencies don't let just anyone come out. You have to, because there's an inherent risk to doing it. You know, they wouldn't let me drive in the four-wheeler, so I had to like walk to the bait site. It was cool. They ended up coming, you know, to one of them came to pick me up because it was like, man, it was so muddy. And you know how mud is, man, in March. It's just, it's like ice. And I was covered in mud because I was sliding downhill, and I wore boots that were comfortable. I wore like light boots. I don't know if you guys have used those yet. They're awesome. I love them. But man, on hilly terrain and slick mud, big fella was having a rough time. So yeah, that was great. What a moment that was for me personally, man. It was really cool. I got to hold, I got to band some hens. We put GPS trackers on them. So it's nesting and brood habitat. So
okay,
researchers are trying to understand what nesting habitat hens like to be in. We don't really have a good understanding of what habitat they choose. Like, I talked to a biologist today. He's like, you know, we got some research back. We're like, a hen nested there, why? And you know, they thought it was just like the worst place to lay a nest, and every egg hatched. No predators got to it. I mean, it's, and so, you know, as humans, we're constantly learning. We're trying to understand wildlife. I think turkeys, I've said this 100 times, I think a turkey can exercise free will more so than any other critter. You know, they can just, you don't know what they're going to do at any minute. So yeah, that's what that project was.
That's really cool. Going to like the nesting part of it, I don't think I could tell you where I've seen like the most turkey nests, because I've heard of guys who are, you know, whatever it might be, mowing their field or something, and all of a sudden they have a hen in their lap. And then, you know, I see other pictures of it like under a root ball almost in the woods. So yeah. That's interesting. I'd be interested to hear kind of the results of that study, just because I couldn't tell you where a turkey is like going to nest unless I just stumble across it.
Yeah. I think the answer that we're going to get is, and this is just speculation of a not biologist, right, is mm-hmm. everywhere. They nest everywhere. We're never going to be able to figure it out, because they're going to do whatever they want. And, you know, like you said, they nest in fields. They nest in root balls. I've seen hens that nest like in like floodplains, where I'm like, dude, you live here. Like, you know that this floods every mm-hmm. year, right? I mean, it's, yeah, they're going to do, I'm sure they prefer, you know, things, and there's things that we can do as habitat managers to help them out. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see all of the research that's being done right now.
Absolutely.
As far as the fundraising side of things goes, what does that look like? And I guess your job is an extension of what you're passionate about. That's what you kind of just mentioned. But I mean, have you, as you started working more on the fundraising side, have you gotten more passionate about that? And I guess what's the best part about that?
Yeah, the best part for sure is the people that I get to meet. It's the members, it's the volunteers, it's the people that donate to wildlife conservation. There's something special about being a volunteer with the NWTF or any conservation organization, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants, NDA, Rocky Mountain Elk, whatever it is. Those are the people that make all of this work. And when I say all of it, I mean wildlife conservation. Without those people that are willing to spend their time, treasure, or talent to move what they're passionate about forward, none of us are here. Your podcast mm-hmm. isn't going on. Mossy Oak's not selling clothes. First Light's not selling clothes. Matthews isn't making bows. All of these things are based on people that give something, whether it be their time or you know, their blood, sweat, and tears, or their money. And so that's the best part of my job, is working with, you know, working with those people. The one thing that I think was really neat for me is I get to see kind of like a behind the scenes of everything that this organization actually does and gets done. And it's like, it's funny. I'll see like, you know, we'll put out, something about like, oh, we're doing a project in Ohio, and we'll put a little blurb out on social media, and someone will be like, well, you're not doing it in Illinois, or you're not doing it in Iowa. And it's just like, there's like six projects going on in Iowa right now. Like, why are you, what are you talking about? And because of my job, I want to know what's going on. I want to know, you know, the progress that we're making. I want to know the issues that we're addressing. So that's one thing that's been really neat is I get to see, and we talk about it, but people just don't always listen. They, you know, they might not see the post, they might not get on the internet. So, and you know, humans, if something's not happening, like literally in our backyard, figuratively and literally, and we're just like, nah, it's not happening. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't see it, so it's not happening. And then, yes, you know, so that's been the best thing is like, I see everything that goes on. I'm like, holy cow, man. Like we are a well-oiled machine. And with just a force of volunteers and people behind us. And it's really neat to see that. That's the best part of my job is the people. And then I get to see the impact in detail.
You know, you mentioned a common misconception with the NWTF is you guys are doing research projects. So all the funds that are coming in, what type of projects are you doing if they're not research?
Yeah. The work that we do, you know, we fund a lot of that through state agencies. So if the, you know, Missouri Department of Ecological Conservation or Missouri Department of Conservation, I can't remember. I think it's MDC, right?
MDC. Yeah.
They will submit requests to NWTF, the state chapter, national chapter. We have an RFP program, request for proposal. And so they'll say, okay, we want to do non-native species removal in Mark Twain National. Well, not Mark Twain's bad because it's national. I don't know any of like your public land spots in Missouri, but we want to do non-native species removal. You know, we've got this contractor or this team of people that's going to do it. It's going to cost us $50,000 to do this, and we'll give them the money to pay for that. Cool. So we also have a team of foresters that go out. They will go out. They'll do timber stand improvements. They'll help with burning. So those are a lot of the projects that we do. A lot of forestry work. We have the largest. We are the largest private buyer of timber in the entire country.
Really?
National Wildlife Refuge, the largest buyer of timber in this country. Huh. And we buy it so that that money goes back into the coffers of the state agencies to keep doing work. So we've got a $50 million forestry agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife or the U.S. Department of Forestry. And you know, that's starting in the West, and then it's moving out from there. So we're funding projects. We're doing projects that relate with like wildfire mitigation. Huh. That's a huge ordeal for humans and animals. Doing the things necessary to relieve, you know, it's like it's literally like fighting fire with fire, right? You're putting in fire breaks, you're burning, you're getting rid of all that stuff. So it's really neat. And a lot of the timber buying, you know, comes through that. So those are some of the projects that we do. We do a ton of waterway projects where we fund, you know, we have an initiative of the waterways for wildlife. That's one of the four tenets of good management, right? It's clean water. That's for all of us. And one thing that's neat is the wild turkey is a keystone species. And I've just learned this since I've started, and I've learned this by talking to biologists. And what that means is you can tell the health of overall species. Like the work that you do benefits everything else, benefits trout, benefits elk, benefits, you know, pheasants. And so the work that we do is just, it's all over the board. We fund a lot of that work through the state agencies. We do land purchases. We help facilitate that. Across the country, we have for every dollar that's raised through the National Wild Turkey Federation, we match it with $5. So it's a 5-to-1 match. So if a person gives $100, we turn it into $500, and then we can go out and use that for conservation projects. And they just, man, they run the gamut of what they do. And some of it is, like I said, it's real boring. It's like hack and squirt, you know, getting bush honeysuckle out. You know, that's not the sexy stuff that people want to hear about. You know, they want to hear about, oh, you funded research projects in Alabama, but that's the stuff that makes, you know, makes a difference. You know, putting in native, you know, one of the things that's real neat is taking, you know, old ag land and putting them back to like native pastures and native grasses and forbs and providing, you know, year-long beneficial habitat for all critters, not just wild turkey. So yeah, there's a ton. There's if you get on the resources page, you can look and see all of the different projects in the different states that have been funded through the state chapters and the national chapters. And that's not even the hunting heritage stuff that we do. That's just the conservation side. And it's extensive. That's awesome. It really is.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So obviously you do a lot of turkey hunting. I want to get into that just a little bit. We've been talking a lot about your job, but I want to hear a little bit more about your turkey hunting background.
Yeah. So I primarily for the first, I don't know, like 7 or 8 years, I hunted just Ohio. And then I got an invite to Tennessee, and I'm like, oh man, I could start my turkey season like 4 weeks early. Okay, I'm here for this. So that out-of-state bug has bitten me. I do a lot of public land hunts here in Ohio. I do a lot of public land hunts out of state, and I like to move around. I like to have options. I like to be able to get away from pressure. I like to be able to, you know, find them. So I killed my first Osceola turkey this year down in the state of Florida.
Congrats.
You know, I was hunting. Oh, thank you, man. I was hunting like, I think my first day hunting this year was March 14th or something absurd like that. I mean, wow. it was really neat. Yeah.
Did you kill it with a bow or a shotgun? Or you're allowed to,
it was a shotgun.
In Florida, you're allowed to use rifles, right?
I'm not sure. I have a turkey hunting shotgun, obviously. I killed a pig with a rifle the night before I went turkey hunting, so that was pretty neat. I got to knock that off the list. Yeah, man, it was. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in Ohio, right? And I had never hunted in Florida, and the very first day I go out to turkey hunt, I didn't spray down with bug spray.
Oof!
And we're in like deep southern Florida, and it was miserable. I had to get up, walk back. I was at a friend of mine. He's got some land. I had to walk back to the truck. I didn't have any bug spray in there, so I had this brown towel that I took, and I was hiding underneath this brown towel, and they were just—I mean, they just absolutely destroyed me. It was miserable. Wow,
mosquitoes.
But oh yeah, the mosquitoes okay. were—I mean, it was just—it was unrelenting.
Yeah,
like, I've never experienced anything like that because there's like a river, and then there's this cypress swamp, and then there's like this grassy like cow pasture, and we were right on the edge of that cypress swamp, and I mean, I could see this river. I mean, it was. It was wild, man. Huh. And that I don't know if you guys have hunted. I spent 3 days in the Everglades hunting prior to that. And man, that was an experience for sure. Just everything's trying to kill you down there. It was just miserable. It was like 95 degrees. And I saw a panther. I saw bears. I saw snakes and alligators and giant spiders. And it was wild, man. It was just the craziest hunting I've ever. And I'm by myself for all of this.
Oh gosh.
And it was pretty intense. I'm not gonna lie, man. I was unnerved the first day that I walked into the Everglades. And I mean, it is. If you've never been down there, a lot of guys hunt out west. I mean, I would turn off of the road. Mm-hmm. It was paved, and it was dirt for 30 miles. Before Jeez. I got to the campsite.
Wow.
And I mean, you are, it's just the sand road, man. And you are in the middle of nowhere and there's nothing. It was wild, man. It was a wild experience. I don't know if I'll ever go back to the Everglades, but I sure will go down to Florida and hunt Osceolas again. That's for sure. But it was an experience. So.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would, I've always wanted to hunt Florida, but with the crocodiles and the snakes and all that, like I definitely would avoid the Everglades. I know that for sure. I don't want to deal with any of that.
Yeah. You know, it was neat to experience that. I get to say that I got to hunt in the Everglades, and cause mm-hmm. you know, it's one of those places. It's like Death Valley, right? It's just like this mythical place that just, you don't associate anything fun with Death Valley, and you associate, you know, the Everglades with alligators and pythons and swamps, and it was beautiful in its own right. It's a different kind of pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But that was wild this year. So yeah, that was my first swing that I went. I hunted in Alabama with some folks. I've hunted Alabama the last couple of years, and I've yet to kill a turkey in Alabama. I've come so just painfully close each year to have it just taken away by. One year it was, I was on some public ground and I was on my way back to the truck and I had this turkey come into me about 70 yards and, you know, I was 100 yards off of the road in this WMA and this guy pulls up and you can see this turkey in full strut right off the road. I see his hand come out with the cell phone. He takes a picture of this and the bird runs off and I'm like, son of a bitch, I've been hunting this turkey for 4 hours and you just ruined this for me. I wasn't even mad. I was just like, I was just totally deflated. So yeah, I'm not sure that there's a killable turkey in Alabama at this point for me. So
hey, same here, Missouri, man.
Yeah. I need to get to Missouri. I spent some time down there just recently. I went down to the National Leadership Conference in Big Cedar. I did that.
Oh yeah.
And then I went to Olive Branch or Olive Tree. No. Some town in Missouri. I was fishing on the Clinch River, if you guys are familiar with that. Smallmouth fishing. That was
I don't know where that is.
The Clinch River?
Yeah, it's Clinch. Yep. Clinch River. Current River.
Current. Okay.
Yeah. Current. The Current River.
Like, I know that one.
Yeah. Current River. Excuse me. Yeah. That was fun. It was beautiful country. I mean, you just, man, that place is a lot like Ohio. It's got a lot of different types of terrain to hunt. I mean, it mm-hmm. was pretty hilly, you know, down there in that southeastern portion of the state. And then you get up into those rolling hills in the ag land, you get the Delta, obviously. I mean, it's a pretty neat state for the outdoorsman, for sure.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, we've definitely been blessed to, you know, we talk to guys and kind of don't realize how blessed we've been with just kind of the different terrain we get to hunt, the different species and all that. Don't have to deal with the alligators, the pythons, all of that. But we should, next spring, we should set up a public land hunt with all of us and Jeremy and try to get on some birds. I think that would be fun.
That'd be a blast.
You and Jeremy can teach us how to actually turkey hunt because there's our one right there.
Yeah. Man, it's... it's tough to learn. You know, there are times, and especially if you're hunting public land, I mean, that really just, that adds a layer to it. With other people, just like hunting deer, you know, pressure mm-hmm. obviously changes the game. But, I think the one thing with public land is, like, I get in my mind, I have to walk 12 miles every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, find a turkey. And sometimes you do, sometimes it's just hard to get out. Like I'm very much like, oh, next ridge. They're going to be over there. So yeah, that's tough.
See, the public land around us, most of it is pretty small, unless we go down to Mark Twain, which is at least an hour from us. And we haven't ever went down there. I don't know why, but most of the land that's closer is too small for to walk that far, and it gets pressured really hard. And then all of our birds, I mean, everyone says a turkey are stupid, which sometimes they are, but most times, I mean, they're pretty smart, because one of them has a gun range on it, and the gun range extends like way too far, and all the turkey just hang out behind the gun range in this big section that we can't cross into. And then another place I was hunting this year, I mean, I had birds fired up and they were answering me, and me and my buddy were walking, we walked all the way back to this back corner, and I'm like, okay, they should be right in this field. And we get to where this field is, and there's a fence there, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I pull up Onyx and they're all in the next tree line across the field on private land, and I'm just like, yeah, of course they are. And you know, no birds were on our public land, on that public land, at least making noise on our public land. And you know, it adds a new layer to it, that smaller public land that, you know, gets pressured pretty hard during season, because I mean, season here is only 3 weeks. So
yeah, that's tough. And you know, especially if you're doing that on a weekend, I mean, you're gonna get everyone that wants to get out there. You know, you are gonna have a lot of pressure. I hunted New York State this year.
Really?
I hunted in the Catskill Mountains, and it was chopped up public land, and everything was under 300 acres. And this is the Friday before Memorial Day,
okay,
which, you know, traditionally, like, you don't think that as like being good turkey hunting time. And it was wild, man. I mean, the turkeys were responsive. But it was, I've normally, you want those big, you know, 1500 up, you know, acre properties, you know, or 15,000 acres. You're like, run everywhere. And I had the property that the piece that I hunted was like 280 acres, and it was a blast. I was the only one out there. That definitely helped. But
yeah,
it was neat. And I guess it's just looking for that opportunity. And sometimes those small properties can really be dynamic. But you just hope that you're the only one there that day. So
yeah.
Yeah, we had sort of that same experience with a deer hunting spot this year. It's only like, I don't know, 100 acres, something like that. And it's kind of in a good geographical location where a lot of people from Springfield don't make it up there. It's just a little bit too far. And we've got closer, bigger areas around here. But I mean, we saw tons of deer up there. We actually saw tons of turkey too. I saw a group of like, I know it's going to sound exaggerated, but I saw a group of like 30 or 40 birds, like at least. And I have a video of it. They're kind of just like ducklings, almost just walking in a row through the woods. And this was in the fall, and unfortunately too far to shoot. But I mean, they're little hidden gems and small pockets everywhere. But I think you hit the nail on the head. It really comes down to pressure. Like out there, you can rifle hunt out there. So we were doing a lot of bow hunting out there. But during the rifle season, I mean, things just got crazy out there. We stopped seeing deer. The pressure really kind of killed that spot for us. So I know we're excited to go back there this year, but we're excited before rifle season. We probably won't go back there very much after rifle season.
Yeah, it gets tore up, I'm sure, after that. Yeah. So
yeah, you got people sitting 40 yards from you and just crazy stuff like that.
Yeah, that I did have that happen. Youth hunt, guy sat up. I had a buddy, took him first time out, had him with a crossbow. And, you know, I see this light coming to me early. And, you know, I first flash like a green light, just like, hey, I'm here. keeps coming. So I'm like, I flash a red light and guy keeps coming. So finally I look at my buddy. I'm like, so this is probably going to ruin the morning hunt, but I'm not getting shot today. And I just turn on my strobe and guy comes in, sits 80 yards in front of me, straight in front of us. And I'm just, I ranged it with my rangefinder and I'm like, this crossbow could reach you so easy and you're sitting straight in front of me. It was just, but I mean, that's so what you get. That's what you get with public land too. I mean, you know, it's, we can complain about it, but it's also like, well, I guess they have every right to be here as much as I do, but it really sucked.
Definitely every right to be on the property, but there's gotta be some etiquette and some respect for fellow hunters.
Yeah.
Right. You know, written or unwritten.
It's one thing if you don't know they're there. Like if, you know, you come in the afternoon, but in the morning, I was like, there's no way you miss this, but it is what it is. But let's get into kind of the topic that everyone talks about when it comes to turkey season, and that's turkey population, or just when everyone talks about turkey, I guess. But, you know, for me personally, I don't know what you saw and what you've seen being part of the NWTF and being in Iowa. For us, at least this year, even though we didn't kill a bird, we saw a lot more. And even kind of after season, when poults were starting to show up and stuff, it looked like we had a good hatch. So it's encouraging, but numbers, at least here, from what I've been told, I haven't been, I mean, we've been turkey hunting, what, 5 years? You know, numbers have definitely even decreased in the time that we've been hunting because we have a farm that we hunt and we had, you know, I think it was 19 birds that would circle kind of this, just our little chunk of land. And we haven't seen near that many since, you know, that was probably 4 or 5 years ago when we started. And now it's like a turkey here, few here, and it's does that sound like Ohio at all, or what's Ohio like?
Yeah, so I'm gonna preface this part of the conversation again by saying I am not a biologist. I ask people that are biologists and researchers, I ask them questions, I try to understand. And so Ohio, we'll start there. We, in 2022, we dropped our bag limit from 2 bearded turkeys in the spring to 1 bearded turkey.
Oh, wow.
So 22 and 23, we had one turkey in the spring. They attributed to that to 3 consecutive years of below average poult per hen survival. So in Ohio, our poult per hen at the time was 2.4 or 2.8, something like that. And then it dropped below 2 to like 1.8 or 7, whatever it is, because of cold, wet spring. So turkeys can't regulate their body temperatures for the first 2 weeks of their life. So if you get a turkey that hatches, hens lay eggs, they incubate for 28 days, turkeys hatch, 2 weeks, can't regulate. If you get a cold snap, you know, where it's 40 and raining, like you get in Missouri, you get in Alabama, you get in Ohio, you get all over the country other than like Florida, you can have those just nasty cold, wet springs. It could just be a day or two. It could be 3 days, and you're gonna see that number drop. So when we look at like populations, what's the number one issue with turkey populations across the country? No one knows. That's the first answer. Weather is, when you talk to a lot of these guys, you know, biologists and researchers, weather is like, it has the greatest impact because it's a huge impact on a state, like a state level, like a landscape level impact. And then you add in predation, you add in degradation of habitat. You know, if you're on a property that, you know, you've been hunting for 20 years, in 20 years, I've seen turkey. Well, what habitat improvements have you done in 20 years? I haven't done anything. Managed for deer, I've been putting flue pots. That's not it, man. You know, we're talking a loss of nesting habitat and brood habitat, which is that crucial. You talk to biologists, they call it poult recruitment. Poult recruitment. How many poults can we bring onto the land, or kind of hand bring onto the landscape every year? So when all of that, when you add in all of those things, you get a drop in population. You look at like the reintroduction of the species across, you know, the reintroduction of wild turkey. I mean, just in our lifetimes, I mean, I was born in 82. I mean, we've seen a huge number in population, like population growth. So there's carrying capacity and all these things that these biologists talk about, where it's, you know, the populations were going to drop inevitably because they were super high, overly inflated, artificially inflated, whatever they want to say. And so we've seen a drop. And then you add in all of the other things, the weather, the predators. You know, Michael Chamberlain, Dr. Chamberlain from the University of Georgia, talks about how like modern agriculture process, or where you just strip fields. So you have that, like you have a wood line and you have like a little tiny bit of weeds, and then it's just dirt, beans, corn, whatever it is. That's not quality nesting habitat. Turkeys need that, like that transition, that early successional habitat for nesting and brood. Brood is raising the little baby turkeys. And so we've lost a lot of that in this country. And that's all 49 states that have turkeys. That's every single one of them. We haven't seen, some areas of the country are having more trouble with their populations than others. Southeast is really getting hit. Wisconsin, Minnesota, booming with turkeys. The population issue, it's real easy for people, especially online, man, there's so much negativity and hate. It's real easy for people to say, well, it's raccoons. And that's all they focus on. I mean, we've had organizations that have formed, like their number one issue is like predators. That's just a part of the problem, right? That's just a piece of the puzzle. It's a piece of that, those big, broad, habitat management practices and management practices. And I think there's a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic for turkey populations in this country. A lot of the states in the South that had some issues, we've seen that poult number go up. We saw the harvest go up in a lot of those states, not all of them. Some states are still struggling. Ohio, we had one turkey. So our last year with turkeys, two turkeys, we had about 18,000 turkeys killed with our two turkey bag limit. This year we had like almost 15,000 killed with our one turkey bag limit. Last year it was 11,000. So we've seen that rise, and we've seen good weather patterns, poult numbers go up. So there are things to be optimistic about. It's easy for people to be like, nah, turkeys are gone, it's never coming back. We need to, like, collectively as landowners, as public land hunters, we need to, what can we do? Like Ohio, 96% of the land in Ohio is privately owned.
Wow.
So when you talk about landscape level impact for wildlife habitat, and this is not just for turkeys, this is for pheasants, for deer, for rabbits, for quail, all of it, the private landowners, there's a lot of them that are doing really good work to manage the habitat. And then there's a lot of people that there's opportunity to be better. So, populations, have they struggled? Absolutely. You can't deny that. I mean, I've seen it. I think a lot of it too. And how do I say this without sounding like a jerk? I think a lot of it too is people are hunting the same way that they have been for 25 years. They're hunting the same ground blind. They're hunting the same farm. They're not doing anything different, And I go out to an area and if I travel around south, I'm like, that sucks. Turkeys are terrible. And I go out, I'm like, there are like seven turkeys gobbling today. I don't know what you're angry about, And so I think there's some hunting styles need to change because, you could have turkeys on a farm 10 years ago. You've done nothing or very little habitat improvement. And the forest has aged, things have changed, and those turkeys are 2 miles down the road on a farm that no one hunts.
Mm-hmm.
But your mind, like, well, there's no turkeys here. And that's just, but once again, that's like a small sample of the issue, right? I mean, it's a small little sliver. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for land managers, for turkey hunters, for conservationists in this country. Yeah, the NWTF just a couple weeks ago rolled out the Habitat for the Hat initiative. It's an 18-state 10-year initiative to improve 1 million acres of nesting and brood habitat. And so you've got the nesting habitat and the brood habitat are, and I've just recently learned this, like they're different things, but they need to be close together because you can't have a tiny little baby turkey that's trying to work its way through a knee-high pasture, to get to a bug buffet. It's interesting. There's so much that goes into it. When we manipulate the habitats, that these turkeys live in, we got to help them out a little bit. And that's what this initiative is about, is basing those habitat efforts on good, sound, novel research that's been going on now and just in the last couple of years. So a lot to be optimistic about. It's not all doom and gloom. For those who are listening, deep breath. There are a lot of people that are laser focused on getting a handle of these populations challenges across the country.
Yeah. I
hope that answered your question. That was a little wordy there. Sorry about that.
No, you answered it. I was going to just add, we've kind of seen that just not through necessarily practice, but just through observation of what others are doing. And, some guys hit the traps hard. Some guys hit coyote hunting hard, which does help. But like you said, it's just a piece of the puzzle. If you're doing that, but you're not giving them the habitat they need, you're really not doing anything for them. Because, no matter how many coyotes or coons you're going to kill, there's still going to be a coyote or coon out there that can get to them. So yeah. I think it's good that you kind of brought that point up, just because it's not just one thing, and it's not just, the coon population or whatever it is. It's kind of this full-fledged puzzle that if we put it all together, that's where we see a difference. And I think, I don't know, but for me, I've heard kind of that before, and in my area, I've seen a little bit more of that, where there's guys who are taking care of the predators, there's guys who are actually taking care of the habitat. We were talking with Dr. Grant Woods kind of about deer, but he mentioned TSI and doing that, and just cleaning up the woods a little bit, and clean up your timber and different things like that can all make a big difference.
I did a podcast today for the NWTF. The biologist said, he's like, if you're standing in the woods and you look up and you can't see the sky, that's too much coverage.
Yeah.
The turkeys need that early successional habitat. They need that stuff growing on the forest floor. They need that for cover, for bugs. Those small plants, they hold the bugs, where the turkeys feast, and it gives them protection. And I think I mentioned that Chamberlain says that we've allowed predators to be more efficient at killing turkeys and nest raiding because of the loss of good quality habitat a lot of these areas. So there's a lot of pieces that go to that circle.
I was kind of sitting here thinking about the pieces that we have some control over, like weather. We can't really do anything about that. I mean, if someone figures that out, then let me know, because I'm ready to turn the thermostat down a little bit. It's supposed to be 100 degrees here tomorrow, but
my goodness,
yeah, it's gonna be miserable. It's just like the humidity in the morning is like a coat on you, basically. I mean, it's awful. But then, predators, and we've kind of talked a little bit about that, trying to get more into trapping, taking out some of the predators, but then also improving the habitat. I am interested because, one issue that I see with that, and not to be the guy that points out the problems here, I'm more so just bringing it up to get your opinion on it. But you talked about how in Ohio, 96% of the land is privately owned. And I don't know what that number is here, but I'd venture to say it's a pretty high percentage here as well. And then you talked about how for agriculture, for example, how it's sort of treated. And, I know that a lot of people see their property as a way to make money, and they're trying to not necessarily, I mean, really, honestly, a lot of people aren't concerned about conservation, I would venture to say. And a lot of people see their land as an investment, as a way to make money. How do you think we can present it in a way that is beneficial to someone who is trying to make money on it, whether it's running cattle, whether it's haying it, growing crops? I mean, I definitely think that there needs to be a compromise there, but I'm curious what your perspective is, and if you have any sort of experience just talking to landowners who are like, well, I could do that. I could leave more native grasses, but I'm going to lose some of my crops to be able to do that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think what like the American farmer, what they go through day in and day out, man, to scratch a living, out, and I'm not talking about a big corporate conglomerates, you know, that are just faceless entities.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about the mom and pop family farm. What they go through to scratch out an existence to keep us all, you know, moving and fed. Like that's a task, man.
Right.
So I've got a ton of respect for those people. You know, one of the things that I found, it was kind of deflating. There was it was either a USDA or an NRCS initiative a couple years ago, 2016, I think it started, and it was called Just the Corners. And that was like just the corners of an ag field, right? It's real hard to get like a combine in. And so the government was paying farmers to take to stop farming that corner and let it go wild. And you could put in, you know, good nesting habitat for turkeys and quail and pheasants and all that. And I looked up the number of farmers that participated in that in Ohio, and it was a good amount of money that they were going to pay you to do this. I mean, it was like 20 people. It was like 20 farms did this, and this was like a nationwide. And then so no one used it, so the program went away. I think the there are a ton of resources out there for private landowners through state and federal agencies, county agencies that will help them and pay them. Or you know, kind of subsidize some of that work to create good quality wildlife habitat. I did an interview with a biologist a couple years ago, and I forget who it was, but he made the comment to me. He said, if every farmer in Ohio stopped plowing their fields 5 feet off of the edge, in 10 years we'd have more turkeys and quail and pheasants and ducks than what we know what to do with, because that's such a massive and yeah, that's a ton of money. And I get it. Those guys can't do that. They can't afford to do that. So where's the balance, man? I don't know. That's a philosophical question that's hard for me to answer. I think the way that you have that conversation is to say, hey, here's the programs that are available to you as a farmer, as a landowner, to help you, you know, live with wildlife and help wildlife, but still manage your property so that it meets the needs of your life. And, you know, cause that's number one, right? Like you want to take care of you and your family, but how can we do that and live, you know, respectfully, with nature? And like I said, there's a ton of programs, and resources available for landowners, you know, to start doing that, to where they can do the process and it's like is impactful financially to them.
Yeah, we had, like Austin said, we had Dr. Grant Woods on, and he talked a little bit about that, and it definitely opened our eyes to some possibilities that we have potentially, just to the funding and really I wouldn't say free money. I mean, there's work involved and you've got to do applications and things like that, but there's a lot of money out there that can go back into habitats if you're willing just to do the research. And, you know, Austin and I, we're not landowners. His grandparents have some land, but, you know, they run cattle on it, but it's not a ton. And then there's definitely pockets of woods where, you know, just a little bit of work would make a big difference. And especially around here, like we don't have a ton of ag fields like you'd see in Nebraska or Kansas. Most of the ag that we have around here is like cattle farming, and that's basically it, mm-hmm. honestly. And most of the cattle farms have like some amount of timber. And I would venture to say that most of that timber has never really been touched, taken care of, whatever. So just, I think, advocating and spreading the word that, hey, there's money out there that can make your property more valuable, can make it more, not just financially, but also for conservation. I think that's a tool that we all could use, because Austin and I, we're pretty involved in hunting. We're talking to a lot of people, great people like you, and we just found out about it a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just kind of to tie this in. I was a golf course superintendent for 15 years. One of the golf courses I worked on, we leased the property. The landowners wouldn't let us cut a tree down. That was their kind of like their nest egg, right? Their retirement plan. You know, at some point, you know, when they get older, they're going to harvest all of these huge hardwoods off of, you know, 400 acres. And it got to a point, like we brought in a forester and he was like, yeah, some of these trees, like they're just so old and big and degraded that there's not a lot of timber value to them, you know, take them out. Now that was because it was impacting, you know, the golf course natively, and landowners were like, oh, okay. And, you know, just But that doesn't necessarily apply to wildlife, but the moral of that story is, like, there are resources out there. There are people that do this type of work professionally. They've gone to school for it. They've got years and years of experience, and they understand, you know, what it takes to manage a property so that they can manage it to benefit both wildlife and the people that own the land. So there's a ton of resources. That'd be the number one thing. It's just learning, educating. So.
Yeah, I was going to say that education part, because, like, we didn't know about different things that we had that we could have access to, you know, just in our instance, hire, you know, Dr. Grant Woods and his team to come out and help us, you know, effectively perform TSI or, you know, effectively plant native species in different, like, native grasses and stuff in different areas. And, you know, because when we look at it, it's like, you know, I don't have $2,000 to spend for someone to come out and do a survey or different things. But, you know, there's access, there's education, and, you know, a lot of those guys, if you just talk to them, they're willing to open up and share because they just have that passion of creating better habitat for turkey, for wildlife, different things like that. But as we kind of wrap up this episode, we do this thing called Around Our Campfire. Yeah. And it's pretty much End of our episode. We're sitting around a campfire at, you know, a deer camp, a turkey camp, something like that. And, you know, we're sharing advice. What piece of advice would you share around the campfire?
Oh man, that's a good one. I like that question a lot. I would kind of tie it back to what we talked about with population decline. There's a lot of people that are. I look at anger as passion. When people are upset about something, it's because they care. And my advice, if you are one of those people that are just, you're just negative, you're nervous about the population, and you're just really upset, and you're just angry at whoever or whatever or the organization or the agency, take a deep breath, refocus, become part of the solution. Don't be so negative, you know, and just take a deep breath, man, and just enjoy the moments that you get to spend, you know, in the turkey woods, spring, fall, deer woods, whatever it may be, man. Take a deep breath, refocus on what's important, and keep enjoying it, man. That's it. That's my advice.
I like
deep
it.
Breath. Enjoy your time.
I'll add to it. The easiest way to get involved is join the NWTF.
Yep.
There's a great way. If you're worried about the turkey population, there's a great way. Obviously their money is going to, you know, good causes that are benefiting not just your local state agency, but turkey around the nation, so that maybe someday you can go hunt in Florida or something and battle the alligators and pythons for that bird.
Man, worth every minute of it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for all that you're doing for turkey populations. Everyone that knows me knows that I need it more than anything. I mean, if we've got some more turkeys, maybe I'll be able to get one down, but we appreciate all that you're doing, advocating, raising funds, and honestly, didn't mention this earlier, but you know, for Austin and I, hunting has definitely changed our lives, and it seems significant. Like, I'm already marking days off on my calendar for November, but to hear how it's changed your life, I mean, it's awesome. It's inspirational. It's a good encouragement for Austin and I to be getting people into the outdoors. So just want to say, hey, thank you so much for sharing that. And to all our listeners, thank you guys for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Like Austin said, it's a little bit different episode. We're talking about turkey in July. And if you're anything like Austin and I, you're probably thinking about elk or deer right now. But it's not too early to start thinking about turkey. Maybe if you got a couple extra months, you'll be able to outsmart them next year.
Hey, there's a fall turkey season too.
Hey, there's a fall turkey season.
That's right.
Right. The old timers,
Christmas in July and turkey.
But thank you guys for listening. We really appreciate it. Share this podcast. It helps get the word out to your friends, to your family. Leave us a rating review. That also helps. And with that, don't give up. All it takes is just one. We'll catch you on the next one.